for reason. Until Lyman Bryson's return to the program next week, various speakers are being heard at this time discussing international and American public problems. This afternoon from Washington, Senator Joseph C. O'Mahony, Democrat of Wyoming, speaks on America's leadership for freedom and peace. Last Sunday at the same time, Henry A. Wallace, editor of the New Republic, gave opposing views on this same subject. Senator O'Mahony.
Thank you. Freedom and peace are the primary goals of all peoples. Certainly they are the primary goals of the people of the United States, who from the time the nation was founded until now have cherished the belief that mankind is capable of establishing a social and political order under which the individual shall be free to live his own life and under which war may be avoided. Now, however, after two world conflicts, fought within the space of 30 years with a fury and destructiveness that defy the imagination, it is becoming apparent that it is much more difficult to achieve peace than it is to win unwanted wars. Men are already hopelessly talking about a third world war, to be conducted with weapons more terrible even than those which were used in the last one. It becomes imperative, therefore, if we desire to avoid such a catastrophe, to attempt frankly to face the facts, both with respect to ourselves and to the other nations of the world. Surely we are not deceiving ourselves if we say that the people of the United States have amply demonstrated in the two terrible conflicts of this century that they have no ambition for conquest or aggrandizement. Now, as after the peace of 1919, we recognize the right of self-determination for every other people. We do not attempt to constitute ourselves a monitor to compel the adoption of our own institutions elsewhere. But when free institutions are overthrown in any nation, or self-determination is denied to any people, we have in the past at least recognized that such application of force, internally or externally, are destructive of the fundamental hopes of all people, namely the attainment of freedom and peace. Throughout this century, our people have cherished the confidence that mankind can perfect a world organization to provide peaceful settlement of all international disputes, promote disarmament, and banish war. If we have failed in attaining these objectives, the failure has been due not to any purpose of preserving for ourselves opportunity to gain dominance over any other people or area, but solely because of human frailty in selecting the proper course of action to gain the desired end. Personal rivalry and purely partisan rivalry have impeded us in taking the effective world leadership which we should take in the effort to establish permanent peace and freedom. But a more serious impediment than either of these has been our failure until now to understand completely that there can be no political liberty without economic freedom, and therefore that the first step in the attainment of the great objective of all mankind is the establishment at home and abroad of economic liberty. This proposition has been stated over and over again by our leaders in the past. It was the heart and center of the Atlantic Charter, and it has once more been currently enunciated by Secretary of State Marshall. Our policy, he said in his address at Harvard University on June 5th, is directed not against any country or doctrine, but against hunger, poverty, desperation, and chaos. Its purpose should be the revival of a working economy in the world so as to permit the emergence of political and social conditions in which free institutions can exist. So said Secretary Marshall. Surely this is a plain and unmistakable statement of a fundamental purpose, to help peoples everywhere through free institutions to achieve triumph over misery. What do we mean by free institutions and what threatens them? When we speak of free institutions, we speak of social and political conditions under which authority proceeds from the people themselves. What threatens the existence of such institutions? Obviously, they are threatened by arbitrary power. That is to say, by the infliction upon people of authority which they are forced to obey, but in the establishment of which they have had no part. If we ask ourselves whether or not arbitrary power exists anywhere in the world today, we must in all frankness answer that it does. It dresses itself, to be sure, sometimes in the habiliments of nationalism, sometimes in the garb of imperialism, sometimes even in the cloak of democracy. But no free person, wherever he lives, whatever his background, can mistake arbitrary power, whatever the disguise. It is the rule of the many by the few. By whomever it is exercised, it is a repudiation of every principle of political and economic life which has activated the people of this nation from the beginning. Free men cannot safely delude themselves into compromises of principle with arbitrary power. You cannot appease a tyrant. That does not mean that you should go to war with every tyrant. It means only that in dealing with him, you make it as clear to him as to yourself that you know his character, that you are not deceived. If any people in the world freely choose a program of socialism, no other free people can rightfully complain. Whatever program any nation adopts for itself is the business of that nation and not of any other. This is not the case, however, when any program is imposed upon the people by arbitrary power. Americans, in their efforts to win freedom and peace for mankind, must not lose sight of this proposition, nor should they close their eyes to the fact that the Soviet government in our time is a dictatorship. When I hear men who call themselves followers of Franklin D. Roosevelt and defenders of his ideals urge the people of America to disregard the facts about the Russian government, I am reminded of the speech which President Roosevelt made to the American Youth Congress in Washington on February 10, 1940, before we became involved in the war. It will be remembered that resolutions were being adopted at that time condemning American loans to Finland on the charge that they constituted an attempt to force the United States into an imperialistic war. President Roosevelt, in his speech of February 1940, took cognizance of these futile resolutions, as he called them, and then said, "In the early days of communism, I recognized that many leaders of Russia were bringing education and better health, and above all, better opportunity to millions who had been kept in ignorance and serfdom. I disliked the regimentation under communism. I abhorred the indiscriminate killings of thousands of innocent victims. I heartily deprecated the banishment of religion, though I knew that someday Russia would return to religion for the simple reason that 4,000 or 5,000 years of recorded history have proven that mankind has always believed in God in spite of many abortive attempts to exile God." This is still President Roosevelt speaking. "I, with many of you, hoped that Russia would work out its own problems and that its government would eventually become a peace-loving popular government with a free ballot which would not interfere with the integrity of its neighbors. That hope is today," said Mr. Roosevelt, "either shattered or put away in storage against some better day. The Soviet Union, as everybody who has the courage to face the fact knows, is run by a dictatorship as absolute as any other dictatorship in the world. It has allied itself with another dictatorship, and it has invaded a neighbor so infinitesimally small that it could do no possible harm to the Soviet Union, a neighbor which seeks only to live at peace as a democracy and a liberal, forward-looking democracy at that." These words of President Roosevelt were pronounced before Hitler turned upon his ally in the ruthless faithlessness that is always characteristic of the dictator. When we became involved in the war, we aided Russia, just as we aided Britain. And we fervently hoped that when peace came and the arbitrary power of Hitler, Mussolini, and Hirohito was destroyed, the great people of Russia, in the words of Roosevelt, would eventually become a peace-loving, popular government with a free ballot, which would not interfere with the integrity of its neighbors. We know now that arbitrary power is being imposed upon the peoples of many small countries in Europe with the connivance and support of the Soviet dictatorship. We know now that the pledges of Yalta and Potsdam have been violated, that little peoples are suffering at the hands of Soviet arbitrary power in the post-war period, just as little Finland suffered in the pre-war period. These are facts which we must face. That does not mean that we should go to war against Russia. On the contrary, it means that we should undertake to prove to Russia and to all the peoples of other nations that a free democracy can produce a higher standard of living than is possible under arbitrary power. And we should do this by eliminating all possibility of arbitrary controls in our own economy. Secretary Marshall, in describing the international policy of this government, has declared that any government that is willing to assist in the task of recovery will find full cooperation upon the part of the United States. This purpose, proclaimed under the leadership of President Truman, is to aid Europe in its own economic rehabilitation. It is not a program of handouts, but a program designed to bring about economic rehabilitation and freedom by the same sort of cooperation that won the war. It is a program in which Russia may join. It is a program of work and production. And after all, men cannot live except by work and production. It is not a program that can be achieved by appeasement. The leadership is ours. Never has this or any country had a greater opportunity to serve mankind. We have the largest national income ever achieved. We have substantially full employment. Profits are high and wages are high. World peace depends upon our example, and we cannot afford the luxury of a class war or even of petty quarrels over a slightly better share of the nation's production. Few in America need more than they are now getting, but millions abroad live in misery and serfdom. We can produce. We can show Europe that by united determination to work in a free economy, production, peace, and freedom can be achieved for all the peoples of the world. The responsibility is ours. We must not fail.
You have just heard Senator Joseph C. O'Mahony, Democrat of Wyoming, speaking from Washington on America's leadership for freedom and peace. Last week at this same time, Henry A. Wallace, editor of the New Republic, gave opposing views on this same subject. Next week, Lyman Bryson returns to Time for Reason, speaking from France. His subject will be 4th of July in Paris. We return you now to New York.